Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. How did the preeminent theorist and philosopher, Michel Foucault, experience and observe the Iranian Revolution? How did he find the revolution disruptive of a teleological notion of history? And how did the Iranian Revolution impact and shape Foucault's thought? These are among the questions addressed by Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi in his exciting new book, Foucault in Iran, Islamic Revolution After the Enlightenment, published by University of Minnesota Press in 2016. This book presents an intimate portrait of the events and conditions that led to the revolution, coupled with a fascinating account of Foucault's engagement with that moment. Historically rich and theoretically nuanced, Foucault in Iran advances a scathing critique of previous works on the subject that charged Foucault with having endorsed Islamist violence by supporting the revolution. This book offers a more complicated reading of Foucault's views on the revolution that disrupts binaries like secular Islamist, while also providing a riveting analysis on questions of time, history, and revolution. Here now is my conversation with Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi on Foucault in Iran. Hello, Behrouz, how are you doing?
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me for this conversation.
No, I'm such a pleasure to have you, and it was such a pleasure and delight to read this book, so nicely written, and it really brings us perspectives on this important subject that not many of us know about. So I really look forward to this conversation. Behrouz, we have a tradition on New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. Could you share a bit with our listeners, how did you become a scholar of Iran and perhaps also how you came to write this particular book and got interested in this particular subject?
Okay. I actually participated in the Iranian Revolution while it was happening in 1978 and 79, before becoming a scholar of Iranian Revolution, I was a participant in the Iranian Revolution. But I didn't focus my scholarly work on the Iranian Revolution for quite a while, in my first works I focused more on sort of Islamic movements around the world and Islamic intellectual discourses on modernity, and I wanted to give myself some distance and some time to eventually go back to the Iranian Revolution and study it without the kind of sort of involvement that I had personally with the revolution. And as we know, memory and participation sometimes can facilitate a research, and sometimes it can be an obstacle to a good research. So I wanted to have that kind of distance, and I went back to the study of the Iranian Revolution 15 years or so after finishing my doctorate in sociology.
So Behrouz, could you describe for us the main argument that you tried to assemble in this book in relation to Foucault in Iran, and perhaps also what are the kinds of readings that currently exist on Foucault's engagement with the Iranian Revolution that you tried to contest? Could you give us a sense of the broader argument, and then in the following questions we'll have the opportunity to unpack some of the aspects of that argument. But could you give us a sense of the larger argument of the book?
Sure. There are two things that I wanted to put forward in this book. One was a new historiography of the Iranian Revolution. And it's always said in the discipline of history that history is written by the victors. And curiously enough, the Iranian Revolution, the history of Iranian Revolution, was rather written by the losers of this revolution, because most of the intellectuals who left Iran and became involved in scholarly work and academic work in the West, those are the ones who actually wrote the history of the revolution. And the basic core argument in the dominant conversations about Iranian historiography has been that this was a revolution, an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist revolution, in which many different groups participated, And but after the revolution, or around the time of revolution in February 1979, the Islamists, Ayatollah Khomeini, the clerics, the mullahs, stole the revolution. And here I wanted to offer a corrective, or rather a revisionist history against that kind of dominant discourse of Iranian revolution, and to argue that this revolution indeed was an Islamic revolution, and in so many different ways it was Islamic. I can define that a little bit later. But if there were any forces that tried to actually steal the revolution, were the Iranian left and factions in liberal nationalist movements who tried to sort of steer the revolution away from its Islamist leadership. And that was on the Iranian revolution side. I wanted to sort of to write a new narrative or new historiography of the revolution. And also then Foucault's involvement in the revolution was always understood by many scholars in the West, and very famously in a book that was written by Janet Afari and Kevin Anderson on the same topic, Foucault and the Iranian and the seductions of Islamism, that the reason Foucault was attracted to this revolution was primarily because Foucault advocated a critique of modernity based on pre-modern relations of power, and Iranian revolution was also a pre-modern form of revolutionary movement, and that was the foundation of the convergence of this Foucauldian theory and the Iranian revolution. So here I offer a totally different kind of reading of Foucault's writing on the Iranian revolution, and I wanted to highlight the fact that neither the revolution was an anti-modern or pre-modern revolution, nor is Foucault's argument a pre-modern critique of modern relations of power. And at the end of the book, I want to show that how this revolution left a significant mark on Foucault's writings and thinking towards the end of his life from 1980 to 1984.
Now, one of the main aspects of this argument is what you do in the first chapter, which is offer a chronology, a narrative of how the revolution unfolded. Because, you know, one of the main aspects of your book is the question of the moment of the revolution rather than its aftermath, how this was experienced. Right. A reader really gets a very palpable sense of the experience of the revolution. So could you give us a sense of, you know, what were some of the key moments, perhaps a few key moments that you focus on in that chapter that is central to the kind of chronology that you developed in terms of how the revolution unfolded?
I think a key moment, I need to highlight that moment in the sort of the development of Shi'i political philosophy that Khomeini puts forward in the late 1960s. That was very much influenced by anti-colonial struggles, and Khomeini was the one who tried to rescue that kind of political quietism from Shi'i circles and seminaries, and advance a different kind of political engagement, and put that responsibility on the shoulders of clerics. So it's, I wanted to mention that because often when people talk about the Iranian revolution and talk about political Islam appears as if this was a return to a past, while there is really not a past in Shi'i political philosophy in which the clerics are encouraged to participate in a social upheaval. And this was sort of Khomeini's the new political theory that encouraged that kind of engagement. And for the most part, Khomeini remained very marginal in the seminaries in Iran all the way till the time of revolution. So that we have that kind of political ideological context which is advanced by Khomeini, and then. In 1976 and 1977, we have a series of events that happens After Jimmy Carter comes to power in the U.S., he's elected as U.S. president, and he pushes the regime of Shah for more political liberalism and the release of political prisoners in Iran. And the hope was that since Iran was doing rather fine economically, and they were not doing dealing with a huge economic crisis, and that kind of economic security gave the impression that the time was ripe for offering more political freedom. So with the release of political prisoners in 1977 and a rather better or more freer press in Iran, we see more and more reflection of Khomeini's writings in the press. We see major events by Iranian poets and writers that happens in 1977. And these events became very sort of instrumental in creating that space in which the most organized place in Iran, which was the mosques, could put together a series of events and mobilize people. And perhaps the most important of all those events were in the summer of 1978, that for the Eid al-Fitr, that there is for the first time in the streets of Tehran, there is a march of more than 1 million people. This is a place that, you know, these kind of marches had not had happened for more than 25 years. And I think, you know, if one wants to mark the beginning of the revolutionary moment, summer of 1978, and the march and for Eid al-Fitr was the most important one. And then a few days later, in September of 1978, martial law was declared in Tehran, and what is known in the Iranian historiography as the Black Friday, the army stepped onto the streets and opened fire to crowds of unarmed people and massacred anywhere between 70 people to 200 people, and the rumor was that more than 4,000 people were killed. And I think at that moment, you know, the Shah's regime lost its whatever legitimacy it enjoyed, and it became very clear that the revolutionary movement was on an unreturnable path. And curiously enough, this is exactly the time that Foucault arrives in Iran, only a couple of days after the massacre of Black Friday. And this is the moment that Foucault arrives in Iran, and the way he described that moment is quite illuminating, because he says that, you know, he arrived, this is his first writing on the Iranian Revolution, that he says that, "I thought that I enter a city taken by fear, but the only thing I saw was the absolute absence of fear." And then he continues that he says that, you know, in France we always talk about the general will of the people, and the general will in political philosophy, in French political philosophy, was always like God. We never knew, is there such thing as general will? And he writes to his friends in Paris that, you know, I'm going to tell you that for the first time in my life, I witnessed a general will of a people on the streets of Tehran. I saw God on the streets of Tehran. So he was very much taken aback by this kind of overwhelming presence of the masses on the streets of Tehran.
So let's continue with that thought of what Foucault made of the Iranian Revolution as it was unfolding. And, you know, two categories that really are central to your analysis on Foucault is this idea of political spirituality and then this idea of the collective will. So could you say a bit more about what is this idea of political spirituality in Foucault's thought, and why is it so central in relation to how he viewed and how he approached the Iranian Revolution?
Yes. For Foucault, the important thing really in all his writings was not concern about the outcome of the revolution. He was very much concerned with the question of how revolution is experienced, how revolution is lived, and how people participate in this seemingly totally inexplicable phenomena. Because he, in a number of places, he had this assertion that that a man in revolt is ultimately inexplicable. And for the most part, I mean, I say this also from my own personal experiences here, that it was truly inexplicable that how people could just stand in front of tanks and armored vehicles and machine guns without fear. And there was something very strange was happening, that strange thing Foucault conceptualized as political spirituality. And in a sense, he thought that political spirituality, here I have to emphasize that when he talks about political spirituality, it's not a reference to the religious character of the revolution. Here he wanted to highlight that something happens, that massive numbers of people find the ability to transform themselves, to become someone that they could never imagine they had the ability to become. And so in that sense, he said that on the one hand, this kind of space, this one can imagine this sort of a mystical space that people go through this transformative action without knowing any idea about what is the end result of that. Of course, the end result of that for many people was death, because they were facing soldiers on the streets. And that created a sense of ambiguity in the revolutionary movement. That ambiguity for Foucault was a source of creativity. It was a source of creative engagement with this revolutionary movement. And again, for him, it was quite an unprecedented event, because in all other revolutionary movements that people have written about, or social protests that one has seen around the world, he had seen and engaged in different moments in his life, there was always a very particular defined platform around which people were mobilized. Here, everything was ambiguous. People talked about the fact that they wanted an Islamic government without anybody knowing what exactly does that mean. And from people on the streets to people in the Shi'i seminaries to whom Foucault talked, nobody knew exactly what this Islamic government is, but they have this sort of a general sense of justice, a general sense of liberty, without giving that sense a very particular sort of blueprint based upon which people could establish a certain kind of governmentality. So Foucault thought that this sort of moment of this transformative moment, which was very much associated with a very high degree of ambiguity, there was a lot of unknown involved in this. He conceptualized that as political spirituality. And of course, you know, this concept was totally misunderstood by his critics, because his critics, of course, if you imagine the intellectual scene circles in Paris, the home of laïcité, the home of a very radical sense of secularism, that suddenly, you know, this philosopher, this French philosopher, is talking about the spirituality and endorsing a revolutionary movement which is characterized by a religious political philosophy. And he was ridiculed for it. He was called to come and be accountable for things he had said, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, I think that was the core of his argument, that he wanted to shift the weight of the revolution from the focus on the platform and the outcome to the realities of lived experiences of the revolutionary movement.
So So let's talk a bit, Behrouz, about some of the misreadings that you misinterpretations of Foucault and also Khomeini that you talked about in mm-hmm. the next chapter. Could you highlight perhaps some of the major and perhaps some of the most sort of egregious misreadings that you analyze in relation to? You talk about Shariati and Khomeini and Foucault, but perhaps could we focus on Foucault and Khomeini and how their thought and their political activism and philosophical reflections were misread by scholars in the U.S. Could you say
One of the major misreadings of the revolution was that when people talk about that the fact that the revolution, there were different factions in revolution, the revolutionary movements, and there were secular forces and there were religious forces. When I went back and I read, I covered a whole bunch of different documents from the time, from different political parties, from Iranian communist groups, from Iranian nationalist groups. You actually never see any conversation about secularism at that time. It is true that there were different groups involved in the revolutionary movement, but this language of secularism was not spoken at all. And the language that was spoken during the revolutionary time was a struggle against imperialism, anti-colonialism, and everyone thought that any political group, regardless of their ideologies, are part of this movement. And and I think this is a very kind of Whiggish writing of the Iranian, the history of Iranian revolution, to say that there were different secular and religious factions, while at the time, none of these groups identified as such, that they're promoting a secular revolution or secular post-revolutionary regime. Of course, again, the power struggle after the revolution is a totally different story, but I wanted to focus on pre-revolutionary revolutionary movement here. And also, even the secular or communist groups, I argue there was a language through which all these different groups spoke about their political agenda, about their ideology, which really collapsed these boundaries between religious and secular. I had this one example of very famous Iranian journalist and poet, Khosrow Gulesurkhi, who in his trial, the very first line of his defense was that he learned socialism from Imam Ali. And when Imam Hussein was martyred, it was exactly the same way that all the anti-colonial people today are being martyred in their struggle for justice. So this is a person who is very openly Marxist, and he says that there is no difference between when Marx talks about accumulation of capital on one side and exploitation of proletariat on the other side, with what Imam Ali says, that you can't build a mansion without destroying homes of the dispossessed. So in that sense, I wanted to argue that under those kind of discursive engagement, under those kinds of convergence of political ideologies, it was basically impossible to draw these boundaries between secular and religious at the time in 1976, 77, 78, and 79. It's only after the revolution, in post-revolutionary struggle, that these lines become evident. So that's one line that I wanted to highlight, to say that everyone reads this in a very Whiggish way. In retrospect, they argue that these the differences existed at the time. And I also wanted to say that even Khomeini was also, it wasn't only the left in Iran which was very much influenced by this liberation theology of Shi'i political philosophy. It was also the Shi'i political philosophy was very much influenced by ideas of anti-colonial, Fanonian ideas of anti-colonial violence and political struggle and so on and so forth. So this space was very exceptional in the Iranian revolutionary movement. And I think it's very important to recognize that rather than reading back to the revolutionary movement, the divisions that emerged after the revolution.
And you also, yes, of course, make the point that oftentimes, you know, Foucault is critiqued and attacked with the argument that he has supported, you know, a revolution which led to all kinds of violence and oppression, oppression of yes, women and minorities and so on. And you make the point that, right, you know, that kind of reading is problematic because the outcome, as you mentioned earlier, was right, not at the center of his thought, but rather the process. Could you say a bit more about that?
That's very much true because, again, you know, this is a totally misreading of Foucault to say that, or rather to hold Foucault accountable for what emerged after the revolution and the emergence of Reign of Terror and the execution of opposition, the suppression of women, and so on and so forth. And I argue there that, you know, Foucault wrote only one letter after the revolution to the Iranian the provisional government. And I really like that letter because the first two lines is that, you know, he says that, "Dear Mr. Prime Minister, I'm sure I'll be the last person at this moment after your amazing revolution that you want to hear an advice about how to run your country." But then he goes on to talk about, you know, respect for the rights of others and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, that's really, I mean, and Foucault wanted to distance himself from the outcome of revolution or not be engaged in that conversation because he thought that that was really not the point of his writings to begin with. I mean, he didn't feel like he was accountable for what was happening after the revolution. Even when on the front pages of Le Monde, the editorial column, they asked Foucault to come and explain his position and basically recant and apologize. And Foucault said that he's going to write this only on the condition that he would write it anonymously. And he wrote this really wonderful piece and he signed Anonymous Philosopher. And he said that, you know, the time of this kind of inquisition is over and you need to be able to develop a critique without founding that critique on a very visible and extreme sense of hatred, and so he was very much aware of what was happening in Iran, and he didn't want to engage with that argument because he thought that you know it basically takes away from the significance of what he was proposing in the pre-revolutionary struggle, and therefore. And he also thought that, you know, this was not his responsibility to give advice to the Iranian government, to a new revolutionary regime, to how to run their own country. So he stayed away from that argument.
Now, another aspect that you talk about quite extensively is the question of gender and the question of, you know, women's rights and oppression and feminist right, politics and so on. And earlier you mentioned, you know, that your book questions this binary between the Islamist and the secularist and show that things were a lot more muddled than that kind of a binary. You also question this binary between, feminists in Iran opposing Khomeini and then this regime that was all brutal and oppressive towards women. You also question that kind of a binary between emancipation and oppression in relation yes, to how, the revolution and its supporters were depicted.
Right. Yes.
Could you say a bit more about that argument?
I mean, there are two different arguments. One is, in the book I talk about this important day, the first international Women's Day, March 8, 1979, that there is massive rallies in Tehran, and this is the time that Khomeini tries to assert his authority to say that, you know, to they're basically testing the water to see if they could implement and institute a mandatory compulsory hijab in Iran, and this rally happens in Tehran against the mandatory hijab, but this is sort of an interesting moment because then there are a large contingent of American, Canadian, French, Italian feminists who go to Iran and they wanted to defend and work on behalf of Iranian women against compulsory hijab. And I try to draw out that kind of contradiction there, that they enter a very revolutionary society, and which is trying to make sense of the situation at a very confusing moment, where politics of anti-imperialist politics, class politics, identity politics, secular religious politics is emerging, and but all that engagement was based on an assumption that from the very textual reading of Islamic ordinances on the position of women and gender relations. And I also, in the book, I wanted to say that the problem was that kind of textual reading really didn't pan out as they imagined, because it is true that on the one hand, many of the patriarchal and at some points misogynistic kind of laws were implemented in Iran, but there was a very significant unintended consequence of these laws that we see in the last 30 years or so. The level of women's engagement in public sphere, the level of women's engagement in intellectual production, women's engagement in education, 60% of higher education students in Iran are women. And these things were also part of that package of implementing Islamic laws in the country. And of course, I acknowledge that these are sort of unintended consequences. I don't think those laws were instituted in order to make that kind of mobilization happen in society. But nevertheless, in reality, these were the consequences of these laws, because it generated a space for engagement of large majority of Iranian women who were excluded before revolution from any kind of social participation. And now the space was there for them to be engaged in different forms of civil society activities. So there are, I think, you know, both, you know, in terms of implementation of new laws and the consequences of these laws in Iran, again, we see that kind of sort of binary understanding of patriarchal and oppressive gender policies becomes very problematic if we actually study how things unfold on the ground.
Now, before I ask the last substantive question, Behrouz, I just want to point out for our listeners that this book has some very interesting and arresting images also that you have. Some dramatic images of the massacre of Black Friday. You have the image of the trial of Khosrow Golesurkhi. This is on page 79. And we also have this fantastic image of the day that Foucault landed in Tehran. It seems like the airport, right? It seems like the Tehran airport.
It's Tehran airport, yes.
On page 52. So I would urge the listeners to take a look at these images also. The question I wanted to ask you, Behrouz, is, so how did this experience of witnessing the Iranian revolution, how did this inform and impress Foucault's thought? What do you see are some of the major ways in which this experience informed his conceptualization of questions of politics, religion, and so on?
Right. I mean, in Foucault scholarship, people who write about Foucault's oeuvre, they always talk about a major transformation that happens in Foucault's writing after 79 AD, basically by after the publication of second volume of History of Sexuality and second and third volumes of History of Sexuality. And people argue that Foucault suddenly, a philosopher who was accused of writing subjectless history, somebody who didn't have any interest in what Foucault himself called hermeneutics of the subject, suddenly becomes all concerned and interested in the question of the subject and issues like ethics and this series of lectures that he gave on parousia, meaning, you know, speaking truth with dare and without consideration, and although everybody talks about this major transformation about Foucault's thought and in his writing, that why he becomes so interested in subjects who are making history, no one, it seems made the connection that these major transformations happens exactly after his writings on the Iranian Revolution. And here I wanted to make sure that's the other part of my argument there, that put some weight on that to say that this major, because after all, what Foucault talks about ethics, he says that, for example, ethics is the ability to become someone that somebody could never imagine that person could have become. And I said, well, that's exactly the way he described the political spirituality in the Iranian Revolution. And there are a lot of instances that I put the passages from his writings on the Iranian Revolution next to his later lectures in Collège de France on hermeneutics of the subject, and I show a lot of inspiration that happens in his encounter with the Iranian Revolution and its reflection in his later writing.
So the book is Foucault in Iran, Islamic Revolution After the Enlightenment by Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi. Thank you so much, Behrouz, for this wonderful book and for your time today. I'm sure our listeners would really benefit from reading this book, and I hope also they enjoyed this conversation. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this was my conversation on Foucault in Iran. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, and that you will also join us next time for another fresh episode. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.